Welcome to the INSS English podcast series, where you can listen to researchers discuss their findings and hear about research in progress. My name is Adi Kanto. I'm a research associate here at the INSS, focusing on Germany and German-Israeli and Jewish relations. Today's topic is dedicated to latest events taking place in Germany, both historically and politically. Only a few days ago, on the 9th of November, the German Republic marked 30 years to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification in East and West Germany. The night of the 9th of November 1989 is remembered until today by many citizens, both East and West Germans, as a night they will never forget. An end of an era, the fall of the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, after 40 years of communist regime, and the beginning of a new joint historical era, where two historical narratives were to be written from that moment on as one. However, the 9th of November not only stands for festive events in the German modern history, but also for tragic ones. The night of the 9th of November, 1938, 81 years ago, marks also the so-called Reichskristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, where the shops windows of Jewish businesses throughout Germany and Austria were smashed, hundreds of synagogues and Jewish homes were burned down, and many Jews were physically assaulted. Some 30,000 Jews were arrested and deported to concentration camps at Dachau, Sachsenhausen, and Buchenwald, where they also were subjected to inhuman and brutal treatment, and many of them also died. Some 90 Jews were murdered. 81 years after that night, and 30 years after the reunification of East and West Germany, it seems that right-wing extremism, anti-Semitism, and xenophobia are returning to mainstream political and social discourse. Latest elections in several former East German states show a clear and alarming rise in the support of the right-wing extreme party Alternative for Germany, suggesting that we're no longer dealing with a marginal political elements, but rather mainstream politically strong leaders receiving growing support from the German society. So why is this happening, and why is it happening now? Who are voting for these parties? What's the effect of social media on the spreading of anti-Semitism and right-wing extremism online? And what lies ahead for the German-Israeli and Jewish relations? This will be our topic for today. So in order to discuss this topic in depth, joining me in this talk today is Dr. Henning Lahmann, a senior researcher at the Digital Society Institute at the ESMT Berlin. Dr. Lahmann did his PhD in international law and cybersecurity and is currently visiting fellow of the Heinrich Böll Foundation Tel Aviv and the Israel Public Policy Institute at the INSS, working on disinformation and information warfare under public international law. Shalom Henning, and Shalom. Welcome to our podcast. Happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with a question which I believe will serve as a good starting point for our discussion today. So we're marking 30 years to the fall of the Berlin Wall, and I'm very interested really to hear your opinion. Is the wall really gone?
That is a very difficult question to answer. I think it is, and I think it's not, in a lot of ways. We've been a united country for 29 years now. The war came down 30 years ago. But there is still a very distinct culture that is different in the East from the culture in the West. I think both political culture as well as culture in the broader sense, there's still a lot of identification with at least every German who's older than 20 with their home that is either in the West or in the East, and that identification has not really diminished, I think, in the past 30 years. There's still there are still two completely different narratives, both for the time, of course, for the time before the war came down, but especially for the time after the war came down. There are two different narratives in the sense that a lot of East Germans, I'm not an East German. I was born and grew up in West Germany. So I don't have a shared experience with East Germans, even though I had relatives in the East, but not close relatives. But there's a sense of not having had the opportunities that they might have deserved back then and since then. There's more unemployment in the East. There's generally a weaker economy in the East. A lot of young people left for West Germany right after the wall came down. A lot of women left. So the, mm-hmm. the structure of the population is very different in the East, even though there are also like thriving cities like Leipzig, like Dresden, like Potsdam, Jena. But yeah, there are a lot of like empty landscapes with like cities that have been more or less abandoned.
Till today, 30 years after.
Yes.
So is this the reason you think, so there's a growing frustration, I think, definitely among East Germans, growing frustration, anger, against institutions, against the media, against politicians, and it's definitely growing phenomenon, basically mainly in the East. What has changed, do you think? If there's anything that changed in the past years, what was it?
I'm not sure if so much has changed. If we look at the beginning of the 90s, right after reunifications, we had a lot of right-wing violence in all of Germany, but especially in the eastern states, the five East German states. Right, I think it was in 92, the racist pogroms in Rostock.
Right.
We always had like more people voting for right-wing extremist parties in the East after 1990 for the NPD in the beginning. I think what's happening now is specific to the German context, but at the same time it's not, because we have a resurgence of right-wing extremism, of populism in a lot of European states, of course, also in the US.
In the US, of course, yeah.
And I think it fits into this broader sense of alienation after maybe 2008 with the financial crash.
2008, I should say to our listeners, of course, the economic crisis of 2008 hitting it worldwide, but also in Germany and also specifically former East German
exactly,
cities.
But also the Euro crisis, which came right mm-hmm. after, which led to the foundation of the AfD. The AfD Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, was in the beginning a party that was founded as in opposition to the Euro.
2013?
In 2013.
Before the migration wave, actually.
Exactly. So in the beginning, the focus was not on the migration issue, it was chiefly on the Euro, but even then they had more traction already in the East, because there was more the sense of that the Euro crisis was especially hard hitting in the East.
Hitting them, because I really want to go talk about this a little bit more in depth. This feeling of being left behind.
Yes.
So-called second class citizens.
Yes.
This is not a new phenomenon. They've been talking about this ever since the wall fell down. There was a lot of, I think the dream was huge in 1989. Now we're marking 30 years of the fall of the wall. In 1989-90, this annexation, actually, of
exactly.
West Germany, done by West Germany to East Germany, we cannot really talk about unification, an equal unification of two states. We're rather talking about a situation where West Germany annexed the eastern
exactly.
parts of Germany, and we're talking about a lot of inequality that a lot of citizens
yes.
experienced since then. So this is definitely a cause for an ever-growing frustration among citizens, feeling that no one really, like transparent people, no one really sees them. Salaries have not been they didn't rise, or there's a lot of gap between the salaries and also the pensions. Chances of East Germans today, former East Germans today, to be accepted in good high schools or education institutes or university or get I think it's still being felt today. So is there some kind of relations or a correlation between this and the very, very alarming rise of right-wing radicals in those places? Because there are cities where economically are doing very well in East Germany, yes. but still we have 24%, for example, in Thuringia, and Thuringen, 24% AfD voters. Yes. So how can we explain this?
I'm not a sociologist, but there is definitely, it has to do with this narrative of having been annexed. I think it's very important to point that out and to say it wasn't really a reunification. We had in our constitution, in the West German post-war constitution, there was a provision that said, like, when Germany is being reunited, we're gonna make a new constitution for all of Germany, for every German. That's why our constitution wasn't called constitution. It was sounded like a formality, but it was actually not. But then basic laws, but then 1990 came, and what happened was that we did not make a new constitution. We did not involve the East Germans in the making of a constitution mm-hmm. for all of Germany, to really emphasize that we are now like a nation again. But we just basically told them, and I say we because I'm from the West, we told them, you can either accept our new the constitution that we in the West had, or leave, or
it's just not really a choice. Yeah.
There's not really a choice. Mm-hmm. And this caused a lot of resentment.
Yes.
And of course, it had their demographic factors. There, like in 1990, there were 62 million West Germans and 17 million mm-hmm. East Germans. So it's also like
geographically and demographically.
Demographically and overweight on that front. And yeah, and we basically told them you have to accept what we tell you. And this, of course, does not lead to them to feel equal. We also, like, there were minor things, like there are a lot of jokes about East Germans in the West that really made this point clear that we don't consider them as equal. So I think this growing frustration found outlets somewhere, like there, and it's maybe easier to scapegoat a distant foreign threat than
to look at the real problems. So I, first of all, thank you for saying that, because that's exactly what's going to lead me to our next subject, which is really the phenomenon of alternative Germany, the AfD, and the very alarming rise of this party in the Bundestag and also in the federal states and the East Germany, former East German states. I just want to refer to the last elections in three states, in Saxony, in Brandenburg, and also in Thuringen, Thuringia, where there really is a very alarming rise of this party. In Thuringen, in Thuringia, just a few weeks ago, the elections there show very alarming results. 24% of the voters in this state voted for the AfD, voted for a person called Björn Höcke. He's the leader of that party there, and who manifests really very right-wing, extreme, anti-Semitic views. So if this is 24% of Thuringia, and also referring to the ones in Saxony and in Brandenburg, where would you say, what's the biggest challenge now? Is it the social media? Is it where to start tackling this problem? Maybe still, I'm really asking myself, how much is the German public really aware of the fact that this party is a right-wing, extreme, racist party, and not just right-wing conservative? Is the German public aware of this? Before even starting to dealing with that problem, we need to understand how far is the German public with realizing what the AfD really is and stands for?
That is a very important question, and I'm afraid it's not, the German public is not where it should be in realizing what threat the AfD actually poses for the constitutional order and for the post-war consensus that we had in this country. Mm-hmm. We always had right-wing parties. We had the NPD, we had the Republikaner, that were also racist, anti-Semitic, but never gained so much traction. I think what we have now is a very unique moment where we have a party that finds a different tone that is like less rowdy, for example, than the NPD.
What is unique in the AfD that you don't find in the NPD?
They have a lot of people who are actually experienced politicians who used to be in the CDU, for example.
And by the way, also in the SPD.
And also in the SPD, we also have politicians from other parties. That know how to, like, they're professional politicians who know how to phrase things properly, so they are accepted within the broader discourse. And
like what you're actually, I'm just rephrasing what you're saying. They're actually using the democratic tools, the liberal democracy is giving them, in order to spread clear anti-democratic views.
Yes, and they make it always clear on the surface that they also abhor violence against foreigners, against people who are not ethnically German. They have this whole discourse going on that they are pro-Israel, for example, because which is of course code for being Islamophobic. They have
and at the same time using Nazi language.
And
by
at
the
same time using Nazi language, but always in a way that they can easily retract or pretend that it wasn't meant in the way that it came
they
across.
They were misunderstood.
They were just misunderstood. Mm-hmm. It was just a matter of interpretation, and we are not actually using Nazi language. It was just like a normal phrase that was then that was pushed by the liberal mainstream media, and because they are after us, that's the narrative that they're pushing.
That right, like that the media is to blame.
Yes, and that they are the victims of like a campaign of the established parties and the established of the elites.
It's of also elite. Like that's a populist.
It's a very exactly that's a very important factor within the whole system of the AfD is that they are anti-elite, like in a similar way that like Trump always still, even though he's a very rich man who obviously is part of the elite, has established that rhetoric that obviously is working.
He touches in a way the worker, the white worker, exactly. American like worker, even though Trump was never came from that milieu.
Exactly, and the AfD is using a very similar rhetoric.
Exactly, and by the way, we have to say if you mentioned already the U.S. and the comparison to the U.S., this is a phenomenon that is happening all over Europe, not just in Germany. We see it in Hungary, we see it in Italy, we see it in Poland, we see it in France, in the UK, populists also from the left wing, yes. But I do want to now returning back now to Germany, and we talked a little bit about the leaders and about the rhetorics. I want to talk about the voters.
Yes.
The voters. So who votes for this party? Who wakes up in the morning and says, I want to vote for the AfD? Is this just, does it come only from, I don't know, ignorance concerning politics or naivety that these are really just normal right-wing conservatives or protest voters, that they were also called protest? Because a lot of people, I hear it in the German news all the time, that the voter says, yeah, we don't have anyone to vote for, and that's why the alternative for Germany is our only chance to be heard. I tend to be a little bit skeptical concerning this. I really think that the people who vote for the AfD share the views of the AfD. So if people vote for Björn Höcke in Thuringen, they share the views of Björn Höcke, and just Google him and see what kind of views he stands for. And this is a quarter of the population of Thuringen today. So how much do you share this? Do you see the same, or?
I completely agree with that, and I think we cannot point this out enough, that it's not just like poor or actually underprivileged working class voters who then like see no other chance than to vote for the AfD. At least the vast majority of people who vote for the AfD share those views and have a racist, anti-Semitic worldview.
Xenophobic,
There are studies, I recently read a piece, there are studies that especially in Thuringen, like every fourth citizen of that state has a very established right-wing worldview, extreme right-wing worldview. And that hasn't changed over the past 30 years, but now they have a party that they think they can vote for. Like, yes. A lot of people before this election just didn't go to the polls at all. They just didn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have seen in this election in Thuringia especially is a lot of voters who never voted because they thought they didn't have an outlet. They had like racist views, but mm-hmm. now they have. Now they have the AfD.
Yeah.
And it's not about, there was an op-ed in the German Weekly Die Zeit recently that was making this point. It's not about like that they were like not satisfied with the bus schedule in their town, that they were not satisfied with
education
or the cultural offerings in their cities. It was that they are xenophobic, that they are racist,
yes.
And they have a party that is established enough that they think when I vote for them, it actually makes a difference, because they're actually going to get the votes not only to then reach the 5% threshold and, mm-hmm. and be in the parliament, in the state parliament, but also actually be a powerful force. And they are there now. They are like the second or third biggest party in a
yes.
lot of states, at least in a lot of East German states.
Who would
now.
Have thought,
yes.
right? I want to, in the last minutes that we have, I want to dedicate to the issue of social media
yeah.
and of disinformation. You're an expert of disinformation, and maybe you can share with us a little bit also the situation. I want to talk about the German law and how German law is able, or maybe is unable at the moment, to deal with the spreading of such hate speeches, anti-Semitism, xenophobia throughout the net. In
right.
Facebook, in Twitter, where do you see the holes in the German law? Germany is still a liberal democracy.
Yeah.
Can the German legislator today deal with this thing?
Yeah,
because there's a lot of talking in the net, and afterwards it's being translated into violence in the streets. Halle. And the terror attack, the anti-Semitic terror attack that happened in Halle just a few weeks ago, was the direct result of that Stefan B., who was a 27-year-old young man who was very much influenced from what was going on in social media. So
yes.
Where do you see this combination between the law in Germany, social media, and right-wing extremism?
Right. So what we're seeing is, of course, a new technology that makes it easier to spread the lies that we've always had. We've always, let's take the example of Stefan B. His anti-Semitism is a classical
right.
conspiracy theory anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that like everything that was going wrong in his life, but also in Germany, was the doing of the Jews, which interestingly is a view that was shared by his mother, who said in
intergenerational transmission.
Yeah, who said in an interview that, of course, my son wasn't against the Jews; he was just against the people who have all the power, and that just happens to be the Jews. And these are, of course, narratives that we've had for 100 years and longer.
Right, antisemitism is not new.
Yeah, and the protocols of the Elder of Zion are not new,
mm-hmm.
but now we have. With sites like 4chan, 8chan on the internet, forums that the state can't control. They're like spreading lies, they're spreading disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very pessimistic when it comes to regulating that. We have laws, like Germany, as you said, is a liberal democracy. We are committed to free speech, to freedom of expression, freedom of the press, freedom of information, but we have much stricter laws already than, for example, the United States. Like, our free speech laws are not as expansive as the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
We have, for example, Holocaust denial is
mm-hmm.
is a crime.
It's a felony.
In
yeah.
Germany,
mm-hmm.
it could never be a crime in the U.S. because it's covered by the First Amendment. In Germany, we have hate speech laws that are relatively strict compared to other liberal democracies.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's no way we can actually regulate lies. Lying is something that you can counter with counter-narratives, with education, maybe with
mm-hmm.
other means that the state has to provide. But I don't believe in regulating the online space in to the degree that we have, like, for example, a state censor. Like, no one wants that.
There is no censor, and that's exactly the thing, that there is no censor anymore.
But who would be legally allowed to provide that? And I don't think the state should start doing that. I think that would be a dangerous path. Also,
I just want to clarify.
Restrict free speech. Yeah.
You think that wouldn't be a good path to walk in? Restricting. Okay. So
what do you think other
options can be for to fight this thing?
I mean, that's why I'm very pessimistic, because I actually don't think that the law is the right tool at the end of the day. And you have to regulate some spaces. I think it is important, for example, to make the big media platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, to make clear that they are not just neutral platforms, but that they are publishers who, at least to a certain extent,
political actors, I would say.
Yeah, to a certain extent, are responsible for what is being spread through their websites.
What about threats against politicians, for example, or
that is
death
a bit
threats?
Easier legally, at least speaking. Mm-hmm. We already have laws, criminal laws against threatening people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if this is happening online, and we already have, I think the police is now getting more active finally. And when they see something on Twitter, when they see something on Facebook, like concrete threats against politicians, against journalists, which has become a really huge problem in the last.
There was a politician that was murdered in Germany a few months ago.
And we just had last week, we had like two very concrete threats against two high-ranking politicians in Germany. And the police was very inactive for a long time, but I think like...
What do you think is the reason for this, that the police has not yet fully captured the fact that there is a real problem here?
Well, if I'm completely honest, and that is just me speaking, I think there is a lot of... racism also within the structures of the police. Not of all police forces, not every police officer, policeman, policewoman in Germany, but the structures are tend to be more conservative, tend to be more focused maybe on left-wing extremism than they were on right-wing extremism for a long time. I mean, we had these...
Was a bit more comfortable maybe to focus on that
I think it reflects also the worldview of a lot of people who are involved, not just in the police, but also in the secret services, in the intelligence, domestic intelligence services in Germany, the Verfassungsschutz, it's called. We have, we had this long series of murders of immigrants.
The NSU, the National Socialist Underground, operating in Germany for a decade without being touched, without being supervised at all. And we know today that there was actually a collaboration of many of the people inside the police and the intelligence institutions.
But we still don't know the extent.
We don't know to which extent, right?
The states are trying to hide it. And
so the problem actually is a lot bigger than we think.
And now, of course, because of the murder of Lübcke, there's a more activity now because there's more pressure from politicians to the police to do something about it. But it's still, I have to say, I don't trust these institutions too much when it comes to fighting right-wing extremism in Germany.
Okay. Henning, I really want to thank you for this fascinating and honest talk. Thank you very much for coming and for sharing with us your views, and safe trip back to Germany. And this concludes our podcast conversation for today. Thank you very much for you, Henning, and for the audience. You're welcome to listen to all our podcasts by going to the INSS website at www.inss.org.il, where you'll find a featured section for our podcasts. You're also invited to sign up for our newsletter and receive alerts for the Institute's various research programs. Thanks for listening, and take care.